It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, as the new Avengers movie slays at the box office, we'll try to get a handle on why comic book characters are dominating popular culture. First, officials in Wisconsin are preparing to ask the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to slow implementation of new state phosphorus regulations. They may have a big number to support their case. State officials announced this week an estimated cost of $7 billion over the next 20 years in order to comply with the regulations. They'll argue that the financial burden on industries and cities would be too much all at once. Here with us now to talk more about this story is Lee Berquist. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers environmental issues. Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
So let's get a bit of a background on this. What are these phosphorus regulations?
Well, the regulations were originally passed in 2010, really during the Doyle administration, and Wisconsin was one of the first states in the country to pass what they call numeric standards for phosphorus. And what this was is that if you are a factory that had a water permit, or if you were a wastewater treatment plant, a sewage treatment plant, you would have to reduce the amount of phosphorus out of your pipe into waterways. To do that, it was going to cost a lot of money. And that's kind of what prompted all of this back in 2010. And there was much objection at the time from business groups saying that this was going to be very onerous on business. Same thing from many of the municipal treatment plant operators. So fast forward, I guess, to almost a year ago, in February of 2014, we have a Republican-controlled legislature, they passed new regulations which allowed for a delay in phosphorus regulations, but only if certain things happened. And one of the things that had to happen was that there needed to be some kind of an economic justification that the state could take to the Environmental Protection Agency to prove that these kind of regulations were going to be very onerous on the state's economy.
And so we get to that big number, $7 billion. Wisconsin is saying it will cost to implement these phosphorus regulations. How did state officials get that number?
Well, they got to it by really turning to some consultants, two private sector consultants, and then a third set of consultants from the University of Massachusetts, from their business school, where they did all kinds of analysis. They queried some of the companies that would be involved. They looked at what the potential cost would be of ratcheting down phosphorus from each one of these systems. They looked at what would need to be done to meet the regulations, which vary from watershed to watershed. And then over the course of several hundred pages, they arrived at these estimates of $7 billion, which included both the cost of upgrades, and also they assumed that everybody would be borrowing money to do this, and then they factored in the long-term debt costs as well for this.
We're talking with Lee Berquist, environmental reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about phosphorus in Wisconsin and possible cost of new regulations. And Lee, what needs to be done to deal with, I guess, sort of phosphorus remediation in terms of getting rid of it in these systems? Why is it so costly?
Well, that's a great question. Non-point pollution, which is the pollution that runs off of our streets and our farm fields, is in which phosphorus is one of those constituents, is really the 1,000-pound gorilla in water pollution today. This is, we have done, meaning we, meaning the collective we of Wisconsin or Minnesota or any other state, any community, there's been a lot of work that's happened since the Clean Water Act in the early 1970s to remove pollutants from treatment plants and from pipe sources. And so the attention has been on in these areas where how do we do more work to reduce the amount of pollution from these other sources. And so and that's been kind of going on a parallel track. But this phosphorus regulation, just because of the way environmental laws are written, most of the attention is focused on these still on these pipes. And so, and when I say these pipes, the sewage treatment plants and so forth, and the factory, their wastewater treatment plants. So it costs them more and more and more money to get a relatively small amount of pollutant to reduce from the phosphorus. And that's why these costs are so high.
Now, environmental groups have made the case that it may cost money to reduce phosphorus, but it also costs money not to reduce phosphorus, and that you're looking at costs that accrue from the effect on other industries or things like boating and swimming.
Yep, that's a good point. And in this study, that was really commissioned by the DNR and the Department of Administration, that kind of a cost was not evaluated whatsoever. And I'm sure that in testimony that will come up to comment on this study, environmental groups are going to bring this up. There was a study that the DNR did independently of this in 2012, which found that instead of phosphorus regulations costing so much money, that actually the regulations would amount to an $18.8 million benefit, just an entirely different outcome. And in that study, they did look at some of the benefits of clean water. That'll be interesting to see how the state addresses that issue.
How does phosphorus affect water? What sorts of effects do we see in the rivers, streams, lakes?
Well, phosphorus is just like one of these little ingredients that helps speed up the growth of algae in lakes and in rivers and streams. So it comes from fertilizer. It's in manure, which the cattle or dairy cows consume corn that has fertilizer in it, and so there's all this phosphorus that is flushed into eventually can get into watersheds, and it speeds the growth of algae. And so then you have the problem of green algae filled lakes. They're unsightly, can't swim in them. In terms of fish and aquatic life, it upsets the natural balance. It's hard for young fish to get the proper to find the nutrients they need. So it causes a lot of issues there. And if I could add, as it relates to Green Bay, it's been a source of what people call this dead zone in Green Bay. And the phosphorus empties into Green Bay. It speeds this plant growth, and then these little bacteria start to gobble on all of this plant growth, and all of a sudden, when all this bacteria starts to gobble up all this plant growth, you start to lose oxygen in the lake. And what's happened in recent years is that you've had this huge dead zone in Green Bay, then that has virtually no aquatic life in that part of the bay.
And we leave it there. Lee, thanks a lot for talking today.
Oh, thanks a lot.
That was Lee Berquist, environmental reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about phosphorus in Wisconsin and the possible cost of new regulations. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Many Wisconsinites head south for the winter, returning once the snow is melted. Gail Folksons often travels with her in-laws on their pilgrimage north, noticing the signs of spring and early summer along the way.
In a flash of orange and red, the first red-winged blackbird of our drive north glides along a fence line parallel to I-35, just shy of Missouri. Corey, a black pug, snores between my mother-in-law Agnes and me in the back seat of the blue pickup, my husband John and his dad Jim up front. John and I, now living in Polonia, often travel with his parents on their annual trek from Texas to their hometown in Stratford. Once home, they'll stay for part of the spring, all of the summer, and a good part of the fall, migrating just as many birds return to a northern home. John is at the wheel at the end of our first day, where we've made good time through Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. Jim scrutinizes a thick map book to find the town of Cameron in the corner of Missouri, and the hotel we'll stop at for the night. The dog-friendly inn has a garden for dog walking or bird watching the next morning. Chickadees swooping over the arbor and plump robins hopping on the grass. After breakfast, we're back on the road. On our way through Iowa, we pass sprouting corn and soybean fields that turn silver in the wind. The second day is the longest, an 11-hour trip with a few changes of drivers so everyone can rest. We cross into Minnesota, making a turn over the Mississippi, and into Wisconsin with its rows of pines, red and white barns standing in sharp relief against the rain's bright grass. Canadian geese and pairs fly over a rural truck stop we take a break at, the cries they make almost dog-like. Corey, meanwhile, has slept most of the trip, although he perks up at this change of climate, the humidity and heat at the start of our drive replaced by sharp, clear air. It's evening once we reach our in-law's house. We have just enough light to unpack the blue truck and for Agnes to fill the bird feeder for morning. The next day, early arrivals waste no time in helping themselves to the seed and suet, midnight-colored purple martins and orange and black splashed orioles swooping in and out of the feeder. Cardinals take turns in red and green pairs, along with checkered blue jays. After a night of sleeping hard, we sit on the deck with our coffee, Corey at our feet, birds of all kinds lounging in the sun of this home up north.
Gail Folkins is a writer and professor at UW-Stevens Point. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. A powerful team of superheroes has swept into the United States and saved the world, or at least saved box office revenues. The movie Avengers: Age of Ultron didn't quite set the dollar record for opening weekends. It came in second place to the previous Avengers installment. Here's a taste as our heroes fall to a bit of bickering.
This could have been avoided if you hadn't played with something you don't
understand. Sorry. I'm sorry. It is funny. It's a hoot that you don't get why we need this.
Tony, maybe this might not be the time.
Really? That's it. You just roll over, show your belly every time somebody snarls.
Only when I've created a murder bot.
We didn't. We weren't even close. Were we close to an interface?
Well, you did something right. And you did it right here. The Avengers were supposed to be different than S.H.I.E.L.D.
Anybody remember when they carried a nuke through a wormhole?
No, it's never come up.
Save
no,
New York?
Never heard that.
Recall that?
Bunch of bickering superheroes there. Thor, Iron Man, lots more. If you throw in other movies besides the Avengers franchise, looking at Superman, Batman, it seems like the comics world has effectively colonized our blockbuster movies. The question, what is it about comic superheroes that makes them superstars of the big screen? Amanda Berry joins us now. She's assistant professor in the Department of Literature at American University. She taught a class on narrative and the comic book. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Veronica. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Well, superhero movies carry a built-in fan base. People have read the comic books. They know the characters. How big a factor is that, that they have these built-in fans?
I think it's a pretty big factor. I also think that it's the intensity of that fan base that has a lot to do with it, too. Not merely that there are so many fans, but that comic books and superheroes have a long history of being very involved with fan response. And so, you know, I think you have a group of fans who are intensely engaged in being fans. I think that's one thing. I also think, I mean, a lot of people come to these films who aren't familiar with the comic books, too.
What about the content of the stories themselves? Is there something from a narrative perspective that comic books are just doing right or doing better than other places?
Well, I don't know if in terms of sort of overall narrative structure they're doing things better, but I do think the idea of the figure, excuse me, of the superhero is a very compelling one, especially in a moment when there are so many problems in the world. I think the superhero as a figure is often portrayed as a, if you will, a normal person who has special abilities and kind of exceeds that normalness. And I think in a viewer, it calls out to a viewer's sense of his or her own potential to do something great. This could be me, except I might also be able to do something extraordinary. I think it's really the figure of the superhero rather than the plot of these movies that are, as everyone knows, pretty predictable. Good will defeat evil.
I mean, you said part of the appeal is that we think the superhero could be me, but that's not true for half of the population because it seems like in most cases the superheroes are guys. How come that doesn't have any boomerang effect?
It's really true, and it's interesting. I don't know if you heard recently about a memo that was leaked at the Marvel headquarters in which one of the officers of the company, and in fact it may have been the CEO, had an email he wrote about why women couldn't be superheroes, which was disappointing. I think it's a sort of age-old concept in representation, which is that, you know, men or male figures are supposed to be or suggested to represent, you know, people, right? All people. And you know, a lot of women viewers, I think, including myself, you know, you can sort of identify across gender that way. This is an extraordinary person, and without necessarily thinking about it as a phenomenon of gender, although that's certainly not true, and you're right. Superheroes are very much about masculinity and about kind of an ideal of masculinity that no human being and no man can ever achieve, except that normal man might someday be able to do that or may have the potential for that.
Do you think that the success of all of these superhero movies tells us anything about, you know, the time in which we live, that people really just want to escape and maybe they are looking for someone bigger than life to scoop in and fly them out of here?
You know, I think, I mean, as an academic, I'm never much fun when somebody asks this question. I don't really believe in escapism, and what I mean by that is I certainly know we have various kinds of forms of entertainment that we seek out for pleasure, and that's, of course, an important thing to do. But I think that, you know, in the field of cultural studies, including the study of popular culture like television and film, you know, we understand that no matter how we think about a representation, even if we go to a film or or watch a television show and think, you know, well, this is just for fun, cultural messages are being transmitted there. And in fact, I think when we're having a good time, we may actually be thinking more than when we are, when we're forced to study something in another kind of context. So I wouldn't say escapism. What I would say is I think it's less about wanting to be a fantasy of being rescued than a fantasy of being able to solve problems that you know, I may have the potential to, at least in this film, identify with a character who can solve the kinds of problems that actually exist in the world that flummox and depress me and I can't solve, but I wish I could.
Amanda, thanks a lot for talking today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Amanda Berry, assistant professor in the Department of Literature at American University. She's taught a class on narrative and the comic book. Report out from the Minnesota Department of Health finds that when it comes to combating obesity, the Gopher State is well ahead of the rest of its Midwest neighbors. While obesity rates have continued to climb in the Dakotas, Iowa, and yes, Wisconsin, Minnesota's obesity rate has begun to decline around 2007 and leveled off in 2010. The rate now sits below 26%, whereas Wisconsin's has risen to almost 30%. So what are our neighbors in Minnesota doing right, and what's being done here in Wisconsin to start bringing the rate down? We'll talk to a Wisconsin-based public health expert in just a moment. First, we're joined by Nancy Sherwood. She's an associate professor of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota and senior investigator and director of scientific development with Health Partners Institute for Education and Research. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So first off, to what do you credit Minnesota's success with obesity rates?
Well, Minnesota has taken a comprehensive and coordinated statewide effort to address obesity. One of the key factors has been the SHIP program, which stands for State Health Improvement Program, which was launched in 2009 and is a real multi-sector, multi-level approach across the state, where the focus is really on helping make it easier for people in Minnesota to make healthy choices wherever they are living, learning, and playing and working.
So let's hear more about this. It's called the Statewide Health Improvement Program. On the ground, what does it do?
Well, it does a lot of things, and one of the things that's unique about SHIP is that the approach is tailored to wherever the different parts of the state. So the overall goal, as I mentioned, is to make healthier food and physical activity more accessible, but the way that people around the state do that is differently. So there are partnerships in different communities working with schools and healthcare providers, city planners across the board to really figure out in each community what are some strategies. So this includes things like farm-to-school programs to make healthier food options available, includes things like focusing on safe routes to school for children, walking to school, making, you know, all the different environments healthier places to be.
Well, the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin's obesity rates is about 4%, but can you kind of put that into context for us? What sorts of numbers are we looking at here, and what does that equate to in savings?
Well, 4% doesn't seem like a lot, but when you apply that to the population level, the numbers are more meaningful. So one of the statistics is that, you know, almost 20,000 Minnesotans who were on state health programs moved from being overweight to a healthy weight. And it's estimated that that could be an annual savings of as much as $9 million. So those, you know, even increased percentage points translate into lots of health improvement and cost savings across the population.
So you really think this one health improvement program is responsible for this? I mean, it's pretty dramatic when you look at the nation that you've got there in Minnesota. You put it all down to this health improvement program.
Well, I think it's a little bit more comprehensive and complicated than that, because the state, alongside the State Health Improvement Program, have been multiple initiatives across the state and across different sectors that are really complementing the work that's done in SHIP. And so it's really the secret ingredient is really that the synergy that has been created between the SHIP initiatives and other initiatives going on in the state around healthy eating and physical activity that have really kind of helped us sort of reach this more tipping point, and also created almost a cultural shift in our approach to physical activity and healthy eating.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nancy Sherwood, Senior Investigator and Director of Scientific Development with Health Partners Institute for Education and Research. We're taking stock of the news that when we look at national obesity rates, Wisconsin's obesity rate and the Midwest rates in general have continued to climb. Wisconsin now approaching just about 30%, where Minnesota's has declined and leveled off most recently. And we're joined now by Dr. Patrick Remington. He's a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So as we just heard, there's some serious improvement in Minnesota's obesity rate, and here in Wisconsin, the rates are not looking so good. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I'm looking right at the figure on their webpage for the report, and it's pretty convincing. The trends that have been seen in the whole nation and in Wisconsin and in most Midwestern states has been a progressive increase every year. We see the number tick up. In only 2003, rates in Wisconsin were about 21%, and now a decade later, we're just about at 30%. And as the previous speaker mentioned, that represents hundreds of thousands of individuals who have gone from being normal or overweight to being obese, more than a body mass index of 30. Minnesota in 2007 leveled off at right around 26%, and they've dropped just a bit. So it isn't really that Minnesota's reversed the epidemic. They've leveled off. But unfortunately, Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwestern states are continuing this increase, and we really don't see an end, at least in the data. I think some things are changing in communities, but it's too early to see it in the results.
And some in Minnesota are ascribing their success of at least leveling it off to this state health improvement program, more complicated than that. But does Wisconsin have a corollary to that?
Well, we don't exactly. We have local public health departments and a state health department. We have many initiatives in communities, and I'm certain that we have some bright spots in the state that are doing the right thing. In the Fox River Valley, Appleton and colleagues have pulled together communities called the Way to the Fox Valley, and people in that community are really starting to change the culture and starting to think about not just health care and approaches to treat and diagnose diabetes and other conditions related to obesity, but how do you design a community and schools and homes so that they're active by design, and the healthy choice with respect to food is the easy choice. It's the default choice as opposed to having to hunt for healthier food options.
It seems like there is such public awareness about the risks of obesity, the cost of obesity. And yet, here in Wisconsin, we're just about a 30%, an upward trend, a trend that matches a lot of other states. How do you explain the fact that we're more aware of it, but it's still going up?
Well, it's clear that awareness is not enough. People can recognize this issue, but if you live in an environment where exercise is more and more difficult to get, where people rely on the automobile instead of using mass transit or walking or biking, then those choices, that putting that awareness into action, is much harder. So we've really need to change our approach. Simply telling people to eat better and exercise is not sufficient. Minnesota has put a program into place that supports communities to do these assessments and then use that information to come together, not just the local health department or the health care, but businesses, leaders in the faith community, and everybody has to come together and make those hard decisions. It's hard to put a sidewalk in a place that it hasn't been. But unless you think seriously about redesigning the community and making some hard choices about how we as she said, live, learn, work, and play, you're not going to be able to turn this around. Just telling people to do something is not enough.
Are certain populations in Wisconsin more affected by obesity than others?
Well, we know the rates do vary. We see some communities, particularly in low-income communities, people who are of sort of Germanic descent may be at a higher risk. So individuals may have inherited a different predisposition to become overweight or to gain weight, but what's common is the environment in which we all live, and that makes it even more important to give everybody the same opportunity to live an active, healthy lifestyle, so that genes and heredity is important, but that means that a healthy environment and doing the things in communities is the only solution. We're not going to change an individual's family history or their risk of gaining weight. You really need to focus on where they live and provide more opportunities to eat right and exercise.
Do you worry at all that all of the focus on obesity is stigmatizing the issue and making people less likely to seek out solutions because it might be associated with negative feelings?
It could be. We have put a lot of burden on people's body weight. Clearly, the focus should be on active living and on eating right. There's research that just came out again this week that showed that it's not so much your body weight, but it's how active you are in the foods that you eat, that people can improve their health by getting active and eating better foods without even shedding a pound. So we really like to focus on the message that be more active than you were last year and eat a better diet, and more importantly, shape the environment where you live or where you work or where kids go to school so that you have help. You have an environment where those choices that you have to make every day are much easier. If you don't have ice cream in the refrigerator all the time and instead a bowl of fruit on the counter, that's going to make that choice when you want a snack much easier if you've made that healthy choice much easier.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington right now about obesity here in Wisconsin and beyond. A new report finds that obesity rates are continuing to rise in Midwest states, except in Minnesota, where the rate has leveled off. And we're talking about what Wisconsin can do to catch up. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Well, what do you think should be done to try and bring down the state's obesity rate? Do you think the state should pass legislation supporting healthy initiatives like Minnesota, or is there a way to do this without getting tax dollars involved? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about the obesity rate in Wisconsin and the Midwest. A new report finds that Midwest obesity rates continue to increase, except in our neighboring Minnesota, where the rate has dropped and now it's leveled off. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How should Wisconsin respond to rising obesity rates? Do we need more money for public health initiatives, or should individuals bear more responsibility? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to a caller now. We have Caroline joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
What do you think?
I, as an individual responsibility thing. So my husband and I did some real simple things with our kids. I was at least 100 pounds overweight for 20 years until having bariatric surgery 3 years ago. But that's what my kids grew up with, my two daughters, with a very overweight mom. But we didn't let them go down that path. We never bought a video gaming system ever. Still don't. We never salted their food. We never deep fried anything. French fries were baked. Only if they got a treat to go to McDonald's did they have anything fried. It was just little things like that that we did that I think made the difference. They're now 20 and 23 and happy, healthy, weight girls.
Okay, thanks for sharing that story, Caroline. And Dr. Remington, what do you think of that approach, starting young and implementing big changes in the house?
Well, it's a great idea. Again, we can't ignore personal responsibility. After all, with eating and exercise, it is ultimately a personal decision. But she pointed out that she created an environment in her home where the kids were more active and ate better without really knowing that. They didn't really question the issue of salt on the food or not having deep-fried food. So that's a great example of a parent creating an environment in the home. The challenge is when communities come together and talk about collective responsibility, then people get worried that we shouldn't take that paternalistic approach in a community by maybe having restaurants serve healthier foods or by having the choice in a cafeteria be healthy choices as opposed to having unhealthy options. And that's where the difficult discussion comes. Are we willing to make those hard choices in communities to create that environment that parents can in homes? But if you only do that in a home and in the Sun Prairie School District or Sun Prairie's community has not made the community safe and walkable and hasn't promoted healthy eating, then those lessons at home aren't going to resonate because kids will go into an unhealthy community. So I think you need both. You need individual responsibility. You need parents being responsible with their kids. And then you absolutely need a community that's a healthy place that makes those lessons really easier to apply.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Michael in Delafield. Hi, Michael.
Hey, I'm a pediatrician and internist and clinical lipidologist on the front lines of taking care of patients. One real quick thing is that as far as exercise, as far as diet and what role they play for weight loss, it's all about diet. Half of my patients say, "Doc, I know I got to exercise more and watch my portions." And that's a misunderstanding. The other part of diet is people think it's a portion control issue. It's all about what you eat. When I talk to my patients about eating a low-fat, whole foods, plant-based diet, and I ask, how confident are you if you did this, you'd be successful 100%? Yes, it would work. The problem is, and there's a level of this, is there's an addictive quality to a lot of the foods that makes it really hard to change. And then when you have marketing and all of these things. So as far as public policy, it's really hard because you have businesses that are promoting unhealthy eating. There's a high profit margin. It's hard. It's, in one sense, it's easy to exercise more than make the diet changes to give up the foods that people are so used to eating. So I work with one patient at a time, and I keep on encouraging. And oh, that's just my thoughts. I don't know if you have any other questions or thoughts.
Great. No, well, that's great. I appreciate you calling. And Michael highlighting, you know, the fact that there is different information out there about how to most effectively lose weight. Is it portion control? Michael's saying it's about what you eat, eating a plant-based diet, and it's not even as much about exercising, but a lot about what you eat. So how do we sort of sift through all the different and sometimes conflicting information about what works?
Well, I think it's a good place to start is a conversation with your physician. And I agree that clinical approaches can help, and that diet is incredibly important. The messages are complicated, and I wouldn't go to the internet, certainly not the television, to get your messages. I'd go to credible sources. CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has a website with really credible information about diets that have been shown to be healthy and the importance of exercise. I look to whole diets, like the Mediterranean diet, which is not necessarily low-fat, but it uses good fats like olive oil. But it's certainly plant-based with limited sources of animal protein. Those populations live longer, better lives than people who eat the traditional Western diet of meat-based, high-fat, processed foods. So rather than focusing on each component, I think you should look at foods that entire populations, like the Mediterranean population, eats. And then there's really good evidence that you need both physical activity as a foundation and then a healthy, diverse diet. That's not eating less, but eating more good foods.
Now, one issue that we've heard a lot about, and this relates to some of what this study found, that it can be more difficult to have a healthy weight when there is poverty involved, is the issue of food deserts. How does that play into this?
Well, it gets back to the environment. If you go shopping and you don't have a choice of fruits and vegetables, then fast foods and prepackaged foods become the only option. And we do see food deserts throughout the state, places where particularly low-income people live, and the options are not there. The grocery stores are not present. And that's a challenge for a community to come together and talk about changing zoning, making economic incentives for businesses to come into these areas so that we don't really make it harder for people who are even more challenged in their everyday life, to make it harder for them to buy healthy foods.
Now, bringing the obesity rate down is something that's not going to happen overnight, not even in a year or a few years. So what sort of time frame do you think we should be looking at?
Well, this is an epidemic that began about 30 years ago, and I don't think we're going to see it go away in any less time. But I think there's good evidence that changes are happening in kids. There's evidence in communities around the country, including Philadelphia, that's seen dramatic declines beginning in children. And that's not unexpected, because kids, as the caller from Sun Prairie talked about, kids can have their environment shaped by parents and by schools pretty easily. So I think the focus should be on kids in preventing obesity. Families can provide a healthier environment. Schools can do that, and then communities can join in. I think it's going to be a challenge for adults who are already obese to lose weight. Obviously, bariatric surgery is actually the only proven intervention to help an adult lose a significant amount of weight, and certainly we don't want to go to a system where we have every obese adult having surgery. But we need to focus on kids. I think healthy places where they can exercise and eat, and then build that into healthy families and healthy communities.
And you're working on an obesity prevention program. Can you tell us just briefly a little bit about what you're doing there?
We do have a program that's been funded by our Wisconsin Partnership Program. It's almost a $10 million five-year initiative where we're working in communities around the state to take this very approach, to build community coalitions and to try and look at things that have been shown to work in communities and put them into place. And then also keep track. Where are the communities that have actually turned this tide and are seeing declines in childhood obesity? We collect information on obesity in the medical record, but that information is not really available yet for public health people to use to see where some communities might be doing the right thing and we could learn from them, and other communities are still going in the wrong direction.
Dr. Remington, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Patrick Remington, professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We also heard from Nancy Sherwood from the University of Minnesota. She joined us to talk about why Minnesota is bucking the trends of rising obesity rates in the Midwest.